You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello, everybody. Welcome along once again to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby with me, Alex Penn. I hope you're well. What a weekend, hey? We have got a bumper show off the back of it with one very happy Englishman, a relatively sad Frenchman, a relieved Irishman who is going to be joining us a little bit later on. It does sound like the start of one of Hask's appalling jokes, but thankfully he's in the lay-by this weekend. So Tins and Ben are leading us out, and we have got the legend that is Mr. Jordan Murphy joining us, I think just as soon as he's allowed to, because he's currently at the hospital where Mrs. Murphy is expecting a mini Murphy. What a week. Fellas, first of all, very much looking forward to having Jordan on. How are we, Ben? I'm going to come to you first of all. You've had a lot to say about English rugby over the last couple of appearances.
And I think it's about
that's digesting over the weekend.
Yeah, but I take it personally that you guys didn't start by thanking me, because maybe if I didn't say all those things, I would have not, you know, got it out of Eddie, who then basically implemented a new plan. I think France basically got the best out of England rugby finally.
Yeah.
And to be honest, listen, it's one of those, it's easy to say because we lost the game, but it's one of those times I just want to thank the players, because the first 40 minutes were just breathtakingly extraordinary rugby. It was, you know, guys, that the clock starts on a boxing match and they just went at it nonstop. They were going to fall many, many times. It just got back up. I think it was extraordinary. There was pace. There was basically agility. There was strategy. There was two monsters on both sides. There was Billy Volipola with his mate Maro Itoje. There was Big Romain and Taofi Fenua on the other side, who had a monster of a game. On a side note, I spoke to Fabien Galthié before the game, and he loves Bernard Leroux, right? You know, the South African-born lock who's very, very good. Don't get me wrong. And he was really scared that they picked two big locks, Willemse and Tao, together. He's like, are we going to move enough? And he was basically scared about Romain Tao. Well, I think he answered the question, because did he have a good game. So now I was actually privileged just to be there, chuffed to be part of almost history, really, to see such an extraordinary game, especially in the first 40 minutes. So I will contain my disappointment and I'll say hats off to England. When you guys play, you guys can play.
Yeah, I don't think you have to contain disappointment on the weekend, because I think if England had gone the other way, I was just happy to watch the spectacle of rugby that we watched. And I, as I sort of posted on social media, I was like, can this be the norm? Because for a year, we haven't seen that intent, that intensity, or look like you're trying to play England as in that intensity or with that sort of passion, and also go out and actually play with the structure that allows you to get the ball out wide and let people have, you know, be exhibitionists, do everything that they want to do. And I had this sneaky feeling. I did something for Investec in the morning, and I had a sneaky feeling that there was a England FU to everyone coming. I thought France were 6 to 10 points better if it had gone the way that it had gone so far. But they turned up and they played. And, you know, I think the quality of the whole Six Nations has been at a different level to where it's been of recent years. And long may it continue. Scotland competitive, Ireland competitive, Wales competitive, England competitive, and unfortunately Italy. But, you know, we can't have everything. Hopefully, you know, they're not going to get up there for a long time. But I just thought it was a brilliant game of rugby. Intensity on both sides. Maro Itoje was immense. There were players immense on both sides of, you know, you just think, how can someone so small like Dupont still manage to get that little hand up to knock it, you know, and just the skill set just to knock it out of someone's reach and catch it on the way down. And there was skill all over that pitch from all the players. Yeah. Tom Curry, by the way.
Oh, my word.
I apologise, Tom, for you weren't in the team that I picked for the Six Nations Lions team, because, Jesus, you're in now, pal. I mean, he was just immense in that first 40 alone, let alone the rest of the game.
From the side of the pitch, honestly, Tom Curry is scary to watch. That's how much work and how much bangs and clashes he does, basically. His work rate is out of this world. His timing is very good. He's not like a Lewis Moody Mad Dog that I played with who would sometimes completely lose it, you know, for the sake of it. I think he's a very clever rugby player, and he is freakishly good. But what I loved about it, I don't know what you thought, Tins, but it's the... There was moments of brilliance from France that I adore, and from England, obviously, but of massive risk taking. Yeah. I have it in my head. I still have Jalibert on his own in the backfield. He's got Curry. He's got Curry and five guys sprinting. I was like, kick, kick, kick. No, he steps, whatever. Another guy and then flicks it off the black. And I'm like, oh, hallelujah. This one went through. Gael Ficou and Teddy Thomas played two quick lineouts 5 meters out. I was like, boys, you guys are, everybody's blowing here. Just, you know, settle down a bit. But it worked. That's a real sign of quality.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And that's what made it the spectacle it was. And I think everyone was sort of at half time, even people who are watching, like, this is unbelievable. they've got to get tired. I was thinking, the more it went on, I was actually thinking, the good thing is about this French team is they answer so many questions at the moment. We talked about it the other week about, you know, people always question their fitness and everything else. And that game was at an incredible pace. And then everyone was still going toe-to-toe at the end. And it could easily have gone either way. And I would still praise that England team. And I would still praise the French team, because that's what you want. You want everyone to leave it on the field. And wherever the cards fall, you know, unfortunately, there has to be a winner and loser. But you just applaud the game at that point.
A game to warm the cockles of the heart, which is not something we've said a lot in the last 6-9 months or so. And actually, just before we started recording and you joined, Tins, I was saying to Ben that the barometer now of how good a game of rugby is how much time I don't spend tapping away on my laptop whilst watching it. I've become a proper second screener. And during the autumn, I was filling out mortgage applications and I was doing the weekly shop and I was buying and selling on eBay. And on Saturday, I basically got absolutely none of the housework done and the to-do list done, which is just so heartwarming, as I say. I just wondered, with that in mind, I mean, you know, rugby ebbs and flows, and we've gone from, you know, a very defence orientated game, and George Ford saying, you know, the ball is now a ticking time bomb. Are we, do you think, moving into a phase where attack is coming back in big style? I mean, is attack now the way to win a game, whereas a year ago it was defence?
I don't necessarily agree with that. It's about your mindset of how you go out and play. On Saturday, both teams wanted to play with a ridiculous speed of ball. You look at Ireland. Ireland's speed of ball, this whole Six Nations, has been absolutely rapid. If you do that, you negate a defence a lot of the time, because all defences do at the moment is they want to fly up and pressurise you. If you up the speed of the ball, they can't do that. That's why you get nines running. When Ben Youngs runs, he looks a completely different player off fast ball. It's why Dupont is so good. You know, you suddenly get the ball on the run, you step it out too. Someone's got to jump in at you. If they're not organised, there's a hole there for your Togies, your Billies, your Tom Currys. And that is a mindset of how you want to play. And if you go back to 2 or 3 years ago, that is already talked about. We're going to play at a speed that no one else can play at. Then it sort of morphed into a power and we're going to be more brutal. And then obviously when you do that, it's just one out truck runners and everything becomes slower and then you can't play at that pace. And I think if people focus on just playing at a higher speed of ball, you will get disorganised defences, which will give you more chance for these smarter players to pick people apart.
Ben, agree or disagree? Rugby is moving back towards attack on top.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I actually think England and France are sort of similar teams in terms of the way that they want to address rugby. It's not the Springboks against Japan, right? Even in terms of physiques and stuff. So they applied that strategy to that particular game because that's how England would have beaten France and France would have beaten England. You know, it's also on the day. I'm not sure it's going to become the absolute norm because you need the conditioning, the pace, the talent, the organization and everything. These were two top, top sides. Honestly, top sides going at each other. And that's how they did it. But on a purely sort of a bit rugby nose thing, I was really impressed with how England... So they conceded a try straight away. Beautiful try. Wonderfully amazing, done. Teddy Thomas, Antoine Dupont, he's always there. The best support lines in the world at the moment. And he's just always there. And then England really did exactly what Tim said. France have got a very rush defense orientated. Let's win the meters. Every time there's a pass, we need to win 5 meters, basically. That's sort of the mindset. And all they did at first was either Yongzi just taking one step or two, and you saw Tom Curry, you saw Billy, you saw Marrow, you saw all those guys just fly, you know, outside in next to those rocks. So what Tin said, what happens to the defense? They don't have time to launch themselves. And then you go again. And then you go again. And then, so basically you killed from the start the momentum that potentially your defense, your line speed defense can give you. And then that's when they shifted outside. And to be honest, I think it's been a long time since I saw Owen Farrell play this well. Slade is very good. I really rate the player. I love how he'll pick and choose, and he's got a good step. He's the French, he's sort of the English Gaël Ficou, I think. They're quite similar. So I liked it. I hope people basically enjoyed it. I hope coaches thought how effective it can be, and everybody will embrace that. It's just two teams that who like that type of rugby, unfortunately, I think.
What did we learn, Tins? You mentioned Tom Curry. What did we learn about England, about individuals?
Well, I think we learned that we've got a bloody good team, fundamentally.
Well, did we remember
we've got a bloody good team? Okay, that's a better way of putting it. We remembered we've got a very good team, and they just haven't been singing off the same hymn sheet. They haven't, for whatever reason, and this has been a year now. This has been, you know, Autumn Nations Cup, the Six Nations previously, where France came out the other end of a victory. This, you know, it's been hard to watch and a frustrating watch for the England fan. And then obviously you see England versus New Zealand in 2019, then you watch dross for a year, and then suddenly you see this again and you go, well, what can we reproduce in this week that makes us go there? And then you get Eddie going, oh, we're not even anywhere near our best. And you're like, well, what have you been playing then? Because you're saying that you were just a bit off in the other ones, and now you're miles off your best. I think it's just more Eddie stuff.
Is it fair to say that it could be the first game when England were genuinely scared? They were genuinely shitting their pants to win at home.
Well, I think that's a very good shout.
The World Cup final.
And I think the fact that they knew that they then had to go to Ireland, and they could be sat there with one win and it only be against Italy at the end. Yeah. There's a massive fear factor in that. But also there's a let's not give a shit factor as well, isn't there? You can go out there and go, right, fuck it, let's just go and... Sorry. Oh, I know we're trying to cut down on swearing. You can just basically say, sod it, let's go out there and just do, let's just go after them. Let's see what they've got. Let's see what we've got. And, you know, you start that way and you can adjust within a game. I've always said that you can't start tight and grow out into free-flowing rugby because it just doesn't work. Your timings don't work and everything else. Whereas you can start out there and then you can always bring it in. You can change momentum and change pace as the game goes.
There's a really interesting point you made, Ben, about whether it was fear factor or whether it was pressure off, because a lot of people were making France favourites. And I wonder whether...
The bookies were, weren't they? Bookies all know, don't they?
What did the bookies have?
The bookies still had England, -1.5.
Right, OK. So, yeah. I mean, that ain't convincing at home.
It's not, but... Considering where they were, where the two teams were, I think there was no chance I would have picked England as a favourite going into it.
No, I went France as well, which, you know, sacre bleu. But I'm just interested, from your experience, both of you, in games like that, I'd love to know the psychology and how you find the balance between, holy, I'm really, as you say, terrified about this, but also I don't feel the pressure because everyone's talking up the opposition. Can you blend that, or do you pick one or other to get you going, Ben?
I don't think it's you don't feel the pressure. It actually tickled sort of the inner competitor, if you had, it had to be tickled, from all those English lads. They know how good they are. It was not 10 years ago they went to the World Cup. It's just that when you know how good you can be, let's face it, they didn't need to be 100% in the last 10 games to win most of them. They didn't need to. Because that's how good they were. But it's the first time that France, if you flick it around, we weren't psyching ourselves up. Come on, we're going to beat it again. But actually, if you really asked every single player, I've been to it many, many times. You're like, you never go with a defeat in your head. But you know that if you don't concede 30 points, it's already a victory. Because basically, you can win it on grit, passion, heart, emotion, anger, pissed offness, whatever you want to call it. But if you're actually being a little bit analytic about the way that the strengths lied, then you didn't stand a chance. And it's the first time. And so basically, England analyzes things better. In France, we back it so much on the heart. But it's the first time that legitimately they could have beaten England. And look, 3 points difference is absolutely nothing. So I don't think England were particularly off their game for the last couple of months. It's the first time they really had their backs against the walls and to be like, we actually can be seriously challenged by this team, not just on emotion, but on the quality. And then it's the competitor coming out saying, hang on, this is our house. This is our turf. If we click, we can play extraordinarily well. And during the game, Jamie George walked by me and he started turning. He was like, when we play, we play. Yeah? I was like, yeah, everybody knows that. When you do click, you go, yeah, I'm the first one to admit it. But then France have been clicking and trying and winning, getting the margin back to almost zero. But England, they just need to wake up. And when they wake up, that's why it's so frustrating, because you know how good they can be.
All games like that are always so down to fine margins. But I thought the reaction of the French players at full time was fascinating. It was all sink to the knees, hands on head, in a we've blown it type of way, not we've been beaten kind of way, which I thought was a very just sort of interesting psychological reaction. And I just was thinking about A, to the Curry turnover 2 meters from his own line, and the Henry Slade hand that beat Jalibert's. I mean, that was a 7-pointer.
Yeah.
And Slade, with his fingernails.
I thought he was actually lucky that he managed to knock it back. He actually caught his arm.
Yeah.
Jalibert's arm rather than the ball, because if he smacked the ball and it went out, it could have been a penalty try.
Yeah. But just moments like that. I mean, that's the beauty of it.
That's what you want. It had, that's the kind of thing. It had everything that you sort of want in a game.
And of course, we're preaching to the converted here.
Yeah.
But it's so good to watch games like that. It just makes the weekend. I know that's an obvious thing to say, but I think a lot of people would say they've sat through enough where it doesn't really do much your weekend. The whole weekend changes off the back of a game like that. It's just, you know, I wish we had those, you know, more often. Maybe we will, who knows. Just a quick reaction to, you know, what's Le Parry Match said, or, you know, Figaro had to say about the game itself.
Well, that's how much you know French press, because Paris Match and Figaro don't say shit about sport. They only talk about paparazzi stuff. But
That's where they've seen tins in the bar.
Exactly, Paris Match, yes. But no, to be honest, there was questions about. So the general idea is to say France lost it in the second half, and the impact guys from the bench did not deliver as much as the English. So there was a sort of an idea of. Did the coach lose it, or is it literally the guys that were on the bench that lost it? And I think it's a mix of both. I mean, France decided to go 6-2, but they didn't get Anthony Jelonge, who started against Ireland and played a killer game. He is not Tom Curry, but he's just one of those athletic number six who can smash people. And you get Cameron Vauquier to come on, and in the Itoje try, you know, he's taken on that driving maul, and then the pick and go, he's just slightly late. Then you get the lock who comes on, Cyril Cazot. It was his first cap. I don't know why they're going to pick a guy, you know, for such an important game and whatever. And I was next to him. He was the first guy to warm up. So there's a night, and you don't get Ntamack to come on. You don't get Serrin to come on, and Jelonge doesn't come on at all. So there was the idea of, if you're going to do 6-2, you might as well use them. It's a strategy. And then Serrin, Ntamack, could have they changed something? I'm not so sure, but you know, but there's a question mark around, did the coaching not impact the outcome of the game? Did Fabien Galthié not lose it? And then the second question is to say, if they finished better, even though for me it didn't strike me as a conditioning problem, but considering that because of the COVID outbreak and all that, that was sort of self-inflicted, the boys hadn't been playing for that long, did they not lose it there? So the questions are there, but there's a lot of pride out of the performance from the boys.
Some of that you can't really argue with how they started. So yeah, I think you could argue about the second half and the subs, I suppose. But they just didn't really get a foothold, did they, in the second half? England controlled the ball. I think they had like 70% of possession. But I don't think you could blame the preparation, because they came out flying, didn't they? And I think, you know, as you say, that breathless first half, no one's moaning about that, are they?
No.
Mega. So I tell you what, Jordan is hopefully going to join us as soon as he can. And I quite understand he's got some slightly more interesting things to be dealing with at the moment. So we'll do England-Ireland a bit, or Ireland-England, I should say, a little bit later on. Let's have a little chat about Wales' victory in Italy. I mean, is there a lot to discuss?
I'll go first, then I'll let the rugby brain that is Ben, dismiss all my points. I actually, for the first time, and we always talk about this game as it being, it's a no-win game. You smash Italy, you're supposed to, or you beat them by 10, it's a bad game for you. I thought, to give Wales credit, they'd showed more control and more destruction of that Italy team than any other team that had played them so far. They were just so dominant in the way they varied the game, the way that they just didn't let them off. They took advantage of all their weaknesses, which is generally the nuts and bolts of the game. Around set piece, around exits, like they can't get out. So even if their attack stalled the Welsh, their kicking game and just pinning them back, they were just merciless. And fair play to them on that. And then that clinicalness that they've had for the whole championship was still there. So I actually came away going, that was actually a really good Welsh performance, rather than, we know that Italy struggle, but I thought it was just such a good Welsh performance, and it sets them up for next week. I think they've got better all the way through this tournament, but I'd still think that France, if they turn up with the same intensity that they did at the weekend, they can get a win. But that's not to say that anything can't happen for this Welsh team at the moment.
So Wales, brilliant. Italy, Ben?
I lost in Italy. I lost in Rome, okay? So that gives you a proper humility pill to be like, don't speak too much about it. That being said, like Tim said, the quality of Six Nations has been up there, apart from Italy's. So I just feel that everybody's raising their game. It does not make them a bad team. It just means that everybody else is progressing, but I don't feel that they are. Then you're talking about relegation and stuff. Who will replace them? Do you think they will not put 60 points on Spain? Do you think they will not put 80 points on Germany? They're obviously a much better side than all those sides. Potentially Georgia, but honestly, I still see them beat Georgia. So it's a matter of, do you go to five nations, but then you have a week with nothing? Or do you just accept the fact that, like Tin said, when people play Italy at the moment, unfortunately, you feel like they're going to win. So bonus point in the 29th minute, I think, something like that. For me, you talk about doing your mortgage. Well, I was there and I just looked at something else. Yeah. Because I was more getting excited and hyped about actually looking at sort of the chat before the game of England, France and stuff. I just don't know what needs to be changed. I actually feel bad for them. And again, when I played a couple of seasons ago, we lost. So it's just it's a current thing. It's not always been the case. But then to go back to Tim's point, yes, I do think Wales next week, they've been very good. They create a lot of rugby, but they're going to fall in front of a very pissed off French team who's there to set things straight, to win at home. And it's funny, I didn't even think about it. It's their first home game, because this year is going, there was 5-3, 3-2. Mm. And because the Scotland game got postponed, it's the first home game. So symbolically, you know, they're going to trash it. Now, how are they going to handle the France-Scotland game the week after, the French team? That's a tricky one, because you need to shoot twice full on. It's live or die, then 6 days later, live or die. That's a very tough one. But
both next at home week, helps, doesn't it?
But that's got to be good for them. That's got to be good for them as well. You know, they're basically playing every game's a final for the Six Nations title. They've still got the Six Nations title in their hands. They've just got to go out and play and see what.
Yeah, what scares me is the whole bonus point thing, because unfortunately, two victories is not enough. Because there's 9 points with Wales, so they need the bonus point at some point, and Wales cannot have a defensive bonus point. So you know, when you start calculating those things, that's the rugby that I don't like. When it's like you said, if it was literally win-win, go, and I would have been very confident. If it's down to just not conceding a defensive bonus point or scoring an offensive one, it's a tricky side. But I do see a comfortable win of France next week against Wales. And by comfortable, I mean 5 or 6 points.
But that gives Wales a losing bonus point. So I've got the scenarios in front of me. Do you want to go through them in detail? Essentially, Wales win, it's a Grand Slam. If it's a draw, Wales are Six Nations champions. If Wales get a one match point and France get a win, so they don't get a bonus point, then Wales are champions. And if Wales get two match points because they score 7 tries and lose within 7, they're champions as well. That is it in a nutshell. So France have got to win and win well in order to take it next week, is what we're saying.
Yeah, my question is, if France win with the bonus point and for some whatever reason Wales still get a defensive bonus point, it's possible.
Then it goes to Scotland.
But and then if they win with a bonus point against Scotland, so they're equal on points, it's going to be down to what, try difference or individual goal leverage or whatever it's called. And that's a tricky one.
If France win with a bonus point and Wales get one bonus point, so 5-1 in match points, the title will be decided on points difference. If France beats Scotland with a bonus point, anything less and Wales will be Six Nations champions. Is that clear?
Yes,
thank you.
I used to have sleepless nights on the final weekend of European round six in Europe because, I mean, there were games. In fact, one of them, Ben, was your Clermont game where Exeter...
That's Bordeaux.
Bordeaux-Begler. And that, I mean, if Fermat's last theorem was tough to crack, that was like, I mean, we entered different paradigms.
That's the point where we should have tried not to win at home against Bordeaux and just take a penalty to lose with a bonus point. We would have gone
through.
But
and
we didn't know.
Morgan Parra tapped and went.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is
a golden weekend for the Norses out there. Come play.
I was just going to try and put a positive spin on Italy, if you want me to, in the fact of what they are doing attack-wise in terms of meters, defenders beaten, clean breaks. They are beating quite a few teams in this Six Nations. Now, where they have got to sort their stuff out is their exit policy. Now, is Franco Smith just going, right, we're going to work on our attack and try and be a threat, which I think generally with the individuals of like Monte Ioni and Garbisi, and, you know, if you get the fullback back, I've forgotten his name, and then Zanon back and people like
Minozzi,
you have genuine threats. Now, that isn't enough, and I think they know it's not enough, but I prefer to watch them when they are making line breaks and they beat more defenders than Wales on the weekend. But it's got to then amount to something, and they just don't have that ability to convert that pressure they do get into 22 into points. I'm just trying to put a positive spin in the fact that they do bring stuff to the party. I think that, you know, that try they scored against England right at the start, they do create opportunities. So I prefer to see this Italy than the one that is really defensive, really boring, that just try and grind down and stay in there for 60 minutes. And it's definitely not a one that you're going to watch.
I just wonder whether you're trying to build in this Italy in the Six Nations, you're trying to build a castle, not even on sand, it's on soup. Yeah. I mean, if you look at Treviso and Zebra in the Pro 16 as it's going to become, I mean, how do you generate any energy or interest or fan base or support around two teams in a league where there's no real rivalry? You don't really know who they're playing. They're away from home, obviously, for half of the season, but they're away from home to games you're never going to go to. You know, what is the benefit for those two teams being in the Pro 14 as it is right now? I would so much rather either they say, you know, we're just going to fold in and we're going to build our own Italian league where we've got Treviso against Zebra and we know we're going to get 4,000 or 5,000 fans because it's tribal and it matters to the people of these cities. You know, and therefore you suddenly, yes, you're starting again. Your top talent can go and play overseas, or you take Treviso and you take Zebra and you put them into Pro D2 in France and you say, brilliant. You know, it's a bus ride rather than a plane journey, and we'll get supporters who come over into Italy for the weekend, and we can actually start to generate interest at grassroots, which will then transfer up the pipeline. Okay, let's have a couple more minutes just on this weekend. Both of you are saying France quite comfortably. Are you at all worried about Wales and the growth that we've seen from them, Ben?
I am, yeah, of course. You know, I've got a lot of respect for what Wales are capable of creating. I just know that I would have been... No, actually, I would have not been more worried. I was going to say if France hadn't beaten England, would I have been more worried? Potentially, actually. Just because of maybe over cockiness, and then you would have think that, yes, there's Wales and Scotland to beat. You know, thinking, oh, the Grand Slam is theirs. You know, all those sentences that you didn't like to hear. But no. So France will be disappointed, angry. So the motivation is there. First home game. That doesn't mean that Wales are not creating some fantastic rugby and that out of nowhere are still creating a great platform for their backs to basically exploit any bit of space that you want to leave out for them. So I think it will be just interesting to see in terms of strategy, the way that Wales address the game. Because literally, a bonus defensive bonus point, they can win it. So are they going to go against nature and kick the shit out of it during the whole game and actually not want the ball in play at all, not let France get on the front foot at all? Or will they just be themselves, back themselves, and go for the win? But I do see the threat, but I see France just being above.
Tins?
Yeah, I think one thing that's come out of it is how good their goal line D is, Wales. I think they've done some unbelievable stuff in terms of stopping tries and their tackle counts. Their tackle counts are so much higher than every other team because most of the other teams have had more ball than they have. But then they've been clinical when they needed to be. I'd love to see their Norse. I'd love to see their stat on their conversion rate in the opposition 22. You know, even Italy, it was three. They weren't scared of taking 3 points to start off with, and then they just build a score. And that's quite a scary thing, is the fact that they're playing that way to win. I do think they have conceded a lot of meters against them. And if you do that against France, and if you do give them the opportunity to offload, this French team could tear you apart. Well, hence, you know, case in point, that first try. So I think it's going to be intriguing, an intriguing match. Am I going to write Wales off? No, because of just the nature of how this Six Nations has gone for them. Their confidence must be sky high, and I think it's a team that will feed off that. I think it's an actual class 15 that they've got. So I see it being, unfortunately, I see it being quite close, which won't help. I want it to go down to the next weekend. Okay, I will do it. I'm going to say France are going to get this, and they're going to go by 8, and then we go to the last weekend.
There is the gambler. I'm just going to throw something out there, which is obviously, as an England fan, I'm hoping for a belting game. And there's part of me that would love to see Wales do it because we've got Lions tour coming around the corner. But I'm going to just throw this out there. As an England fan, I feel that I have had a disproportionate amount of disappointment in Grand Slam games. We'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. Have you had a boy or a girl?
No, neither, mate. We're in for a sweep, and we're a couple of days out, I think.
Yeah. Well done, Jordan Murphy. It's very nice to see you.
It's not how I thought we were going to call it, with a sweep. We've just had a sweep. That's not how I thought this was going to start.
Well, there was all sorts of measurements to be taken, and questions of inducing, and we're 3 days over, so it's right. It's you know the crack tins. It's never easy, and particularly when you don't know what's going on, it's a bit just toe the line.
Do you know what make you're getting?
No.
Cars close to the chest.
Yeah.
Have you
also
had
a Jordy?
How you two said it? Because Ben, how long have you got?
I've honestly, for Jordy, I've got a lot of time, but I've got to shoot in a bit, but okay. I'll stick around for a little bit. Let me try to push. Hang on.
Push. You do WhatsApping. Jordan, it's very nice to see you. I tell you what, while you join, I'm going to give you your, we normally have a trumpet and some dry ice to welcome in our guests. So here we go, the CV. The most decorated player in Premiership history with 8 titles, 2 Heineken Cups, the 2009 Six Nations and Grand Slam, 7 appearances for the Lions and 72 tests. The former coach and DOR of Leicester, Jordan Murphy. Does that all feel like yesterday, or does that feel like a lifetime ago?
A combination, really. It feels like a while ago. I suppose I was very lucky when we started at Leicester. It was sort of success was on tap. Joined in 97, and it was kind of probably a period of change, really, because they had lost the European final in 96. So it was kind of an ambition to get back there and to do it. And then Newcastle obviously had that fantastic team late 90s with Inge and Rob Andrew and the boys and Johnny coming through, and they won the first day premiership that I was sort of over in this country for. And then after that, we just went on a run. So that initial run felt like quite a while ago, right? Yeah. But then obviously having been at Leicester for sort of 23 years, it was it's sort of a spiral staircase, really, because, you know, it went downhill 2003 to 2006-07. We didn't win anything. We were in finals, but, you know, couldn't manage to get it across the line. And then you go back to what makes you good, and you go through a successful period, and then you have another dip and then come back. And I suppose we, you know, won another trophies in until 2013, which is when I retired. So, it was pretty much a long career. Makes me feel old when I think back on it. But I am, all good memories.
I do wonder why nowadays in professional sport, you know, in amateur, you never really got those dips. You know what I mean? You didn't get a bad dip. You know, Bath and Leicester were always sitting at the top. Whereas in the professional area, you do seem to have a team of success and then it dips, and it's almost classed as a rebuild, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's all about the players. I think back in the day, like when I was a kid, a long, long time ago, Tins, there wasn't sort of the clubs weren't attracting the players. Leicester attracted players from all over the world through the 60s and 70s, had a heritage with Irish players. Tony O'Reilly played there. So they were probably ahead of the game in relation to how they were bringing people in and why they were bringing people in. Similarly, Bath, you know, people wanted to go and play there. I think that's all changed. I think now the advent of professionalism means that teams' recruitment is probably the biggest thing that's going on, and people can recruit squads and teams and they do very, very well. You know, I look at what Saracens and Exeter have done in the last sort of 15 years, and both teams and both guys who I've spoken to in clubs would say, we looked at what Leicester did well through 2000 and we tried to emulate that. And, you know, sort of, I think there's obviously a pretty decent success story from both of those teams. So I think the formula speaks for itself, but it's never going to be able to, you're never going to be able to keep it forever. You know, you look at any team, you look at New England Patriots in the NFL, and obviously they've built a dynasty, but they lose a couple of key players in Tom Brady, and all of a sudden they're, you know, they'll qualify for the playoffs. So I think as much as fans expect teams to be world-class year in, year out, there has to be the dips. You got to take the rock with the smooth, don't you?
Well, that's true. Yeah, definitely that.
You're looking very well. Is that because you've got a sunbed installed, or because you've been to bed for the last month, or because the blood pressure is sort of returning to where you'd like it to be off the back of a hell of a journey? Why are you looking so healthy when the rest of us are falling apart?
Are you talking to Tins or me?
No, I'm talking to you.
Hey, really? You're never looking at me being healthy.
But yeah, I work with Tins on a weekly basis, so maybe the benchmark isn't as high as it should be, but you know.
All right.
Yeah, how is life?
Life is really good. Life was quite stressful during lockdown 3. I think for me personally, it was kind of, you know, you kind of had Christmas to kind of lick my wounds and sort of make my plans. And then lockdown 3 was a little bit like, you know, okay, here we go. We're, you know, we've got some bits and pieces to look forward to. And then it was like, no, you don't, get back in your block. So I think that hit quite a few of us. But Zooms, obviously, and Teams meetings have been amazing. I've got two little boys, and homeschooling was particularly stressful. So this week was another weight from around my neck.
Amen to that.
So the homeschooling bit was particularly stressful. I think we need to shout out to all the teachers out there because they do a great job. It was it was more a fear of what we were messing up, to be quite honest with you, how far we were getting behind with things. But thankfully, it's not too bad.
Good to hear. Should we deal with it? You mentioned licking the wounds. I mean, 23 years, as you said. It's nearly a quarter of a century at Leicester. I mean, how deep were the wounds? Where are you at with the Tigers now?
Oh, look, it was a strange one because it was, having been there for so long, I probably never would have left. But there had to be a time to go. And obviously, these are very, very strange and unusual times. You know, the midst of a pandemic when you've no fans and no currency coming through. It's going to play a factor. I was sat down and told, you know, look, you're not going to be here as of May, June when the season finishes, and you can go now or you can try to work through till June. And for me, it was a really tough decision to do. But I kind of thought after 23 years, having never really taken any time off at all, it was probably time to just go and breathe and let it all sink in. So it was a mutual decision really in that respect, and that, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be continuing past June, but they did afford me the honour of, look, you know, if you want to come in and do it, I thought I wouldn't have been able to, you know, give my 100% knowing I was leaving. So I just said, you know, look, that was kind of the way we parted company. So, disappointments, regrets, sure, there's always going to be there. I'm a pretty pragmatic in my approach to life, and I'm a pretty much an optimist, pretty happy-go-lucky. So I, pretty quickly just on with it and into the next opportunities, hopefully.
You're just a legend, period. That's all that you are, mate. To be honest, I thought in your description, seriously, there's that AKA legend that you should have added to this. I was privileged enough to arrive in a fantastic club, like you said, that era, 2007, where Leicester Tigers were winning everything. Obviously, you were playing an instrumental role in it. But you already looked 40. You were probably 40 already. You had everything done in your career. But you were the kindest, most genuine, down-to-earth, super young-minded sort of bloke who really stuck everybody together. So it's a testament what you just said. I mean, you're talking about an absolute heartbreak after giving your soul and your heart and all your blood for this club. And you still said, I don't believe that I could have given it as much. So you're almost putting it on you. You're almost blaming yourself before you blame the situation. That's how much of a champion you are. So no, I think it's...
I think that's very kind of you to say, Benji. You just, you know, I won't leak any of the stories about you from those eras.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, why do you think? Why do you think I came up with all that shit?
Perfectly safe, mate. Don't worry about that. No, but like, look, it's interesting. I one of the big things for me is, you know, you own everything. You try and take as much on your shoulders as you possible. You don't want to make excuses. I think Aaron Major was big on that, you know, ownership, accountability and responsibility. And that's kind of one of the things that really stuck with me. I believe that's the case. You know, you look at yourself in every situation and see what, you know, you could do better. It's a really great learning experience. And I suppose, you know, tough times, and that's one of the things that I found out over myself. You find out a lot more about yourself in tough times than you do in the good times. It's actually really easy to win. it's really, really easy to win. Losing is a really tough thing to do, and to come back from losing and to come back from tough times, and sort of the people that you find, you know, step up when times are tough. That's, I think, there are real opportunities to learn and grow.
We're actually thinking, before you join, you've actually coached half of our Good, Bad and Rugby squad, which is Benji and Ellis, obviously, front row forwards as well. What do you remember of the large hooker that arrived? What was it, 2007, did you say?
Yeah.
From France. What do you remember, Jordan, of our first front rower?
Benji's arrival was, really interesting. You had a nice run in with Lou Deeks at one stage, didn't you, Ben?
Watch out for the left hand.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the first thing that strikes everyone about Ben is how articulate he is. Certainly haven't had French players before. Ben's dad spent a lot of time in the States, and that's why he sounds like an American Frenchman. I think, you know, you fitted into the squad perfectly. And like Ben said, the blend in 2007 was what it was all about, you know, sort of blending, meshing that little bit of an older crew with the younger crew that were coming through. And the reality was, when probably Ben signed, with George Shooter was still there and probably would have been perceived to be number one. And Ben very quickly sort of said, no, look, I'm not going to be having that. I'm going to compete for my spot and actually steal the spot. So that was, I think, one of the things that struck me about Ben. Was just his confidence to go, okay, well, I'll walk the walk, but I can talk the talk as well. So that was impressive. Actually, one of my favourite stories about Ben isn't anything to do with rugby. It's about his wedding day when we went, and they I got taken down by his dad and his grandfather. We'd been having a few beers, and it had been a fantastic day. Ben and his beautiful wife, who he met in Leicester, had put on a great spread for us. And, you know, kind of you get to the mid-afternoon, and at that stage Ben was playing for Claremont, and obviously there's quite a few of the Claremont pack there, and only a couple of guys from Leicester had made it for whatever reason, myself and Richard Blaze, who's now the forwards coach at Watts. And we had some very entertaining conversations at the bar, and, you know, it was kind of typical old rugby club style, but very, very stylish. But I'd had probably about enough alcohol when Ben's dad invited me to chat to Ben's grandfather, who I sat down beside to have a chat with. And Ben's grandfather had made some Armagnac before, had brought it into the table. And I wasn't a fan of Armagnac until then, and probably haven't had Armagnac since. But Ben's grandfather told me, you're Irish, you like a bit of Armagnac. And so I sat down beside him, and he poured two bowls, goldfish bowls of Armagnac. And it was like rocket fuel. And I thought, right, there's only one way I can get rid of this is to basically chop it and do a runner. But as soon as I got anywhere near chopping it, he just filled the glass again and again and again. He was like Speedy Gonzalez. And then just as I thought I was going to get away with it, Ben's dad rocks over with some Cuban cigars that he brought. So I don't smoke, but again,
at that point you do.
Yeah, at some point that sums up an Irish. I didn't drink,
but I didn't smoke until this wedding. And so I'm basically, I've drank about a bottle of Armagnac with his granddad, and I've got this cloud of a mushroom cloud of Cuban cigar smoke around my head. I found my wife on the dance floor probably about an hour later, and she just said, "What happened to you?" So I was like, "The Kaiser's got me." So that's probably a more PC story that I prefer from Ben.
Amazing.
Very good. Do you want to write a reply or just plead the fifth?
No, listen, don't let any of those the threats of any sort of nights out stories of Leicester come out, because they're just not true.
Understood. What about a 21-year-old Bristolian? We did actually ask him. He was desperate to join, but unfortunately he's under lock and key at Penny Hill. February 2016, first impressions?
Again, I really liked Ellis. He rocked up to his first session, and I think he fell out with both of the Youngs boys. I remember Ben and Tom both giving him uppercuts off the back of a line-out, which was quite amusing. I think he quite enjoyed that, though. I think Ellis moving to Leicester probably was a really good move for him. Richard Cockrell was there for the time, and they were very, very similar. And I think Richard was very good for Ellis in that. I think they were both very, very outward spoken. They didn't really pull any punches. And I think that's exactly what Ellis needed at the time. I'd watched Ellis play underage rugby as a number eight, and I'd watched him sort of his ability to run for a couple of years beforehand, and sort of was always impressed at what he could do physically. So when we actually managed to sign him, I thought, you know, this is a great signing.
There was a particular story he sent through about an incident in the car park, which I think came with about 600 swear words attached to it. So we tidied it up a bit, but he said that you'd tell it better than he could, or certainly than we'd be allowed to read out. Does that ring a bell?
It does. Yeah, it was quite amusing. Ellis had an issue in the training ground at Oval Park, and then that he'd like to just go a little bit too quickly out of the training ground on occasion in his souped up Landy. So on a couple of occasions, I'd asked him to slow down, and in the midst of of everything that was going on in around pay cuts and sort of the negotiations and conversations around pay cuts a year ago now, Ellis had come in one day and he'd come racing in, and I basically was walking out of the office as he came in. So I'd basically shaken my head at him. He was late, so he was rushing. So I'd given him a mouthful, a serve, and he basically went off on one. But I could see him reversing, and he was going to reverse into someone's car because he got the red mist, and he was just completely couldn't see out of his wing mirror. So he was about to take someone the side out of one of the guy's cars. So I'm standing outside the car using my I was just screaming at him, stop that. But the more I was screaming at him using a litany of abuse, he was getting angrier. So kind of there was this standoff as eventually he realized that he'd reversed into someone's wing mirror. So he braked and jumped out, and then the apology started. So it was quite an interesting moment. But I thankfully wasn't more damage done than there should have been. It was funnier when you were there. Sorry, Tins.
I can only imagine how much you miss it, and that's sort of got a question mark at the end. Ben Sadie, you've got a paid gig, is that right? Someone's paying you more than we are.
Yeah, you know, it's post England, France, and your schools in England are just crazy expensive. So I've got to work.
Ben, give us a shout over the course. I'll catch you soon.
100%. Take care, guys. Have a good one.
Good on you, Ben. Thank you so much for joining. Commiserations, obviously, at the weekend as well. To go back to that, are you missing it? Or are you actually sort of really enjoying the freshness and the open pastures, which perhaps you haven't been able to sort of necessarily run around and enjoy recently? But
no, I think the latter, to be quite honest with you. As I said to you, I was so emotionally attached at Leicester, and I found that the last 2 years have been incredibly, incredibly tough. You know, we were in a really tough spot for a couple of seasons there, and it was trying to bail water to a certain extent, and I wasn't enjoying it. Obviously, we were down the bottom end of the table. It was a big undertaking to try and get the boat turned around, and it was very, very stressful. I said after a while, sort of Christmas time this year, again, out of a sort of a month, I started actually really enjoying rugby again. I'm not sort of worrying about, you know, who's playing where and what injuries are doing, what teams are doing off 5, 6, 7 man lineouts, you know, what way they're playing. And when you're in that situation where, you know, you're under so much pressure and everything means so much, you actually don't enjoy the games. You're constantly looking at, you know, what anyone else is doing, what the permutations are in around results, in around points. So it's tough to really to enjoy rugby and to really love rugby, I think. You know, and me, it was a tough spot. Obviously, it's a really privileged thing to be able to do, and I wouldn't say from that reason I don't want to seem ungrateful, because you know, to be able to be involved in professional rugby in any guise is an unbelievable honour. But it did feel like a little bit of a weight off my neck. I'm not going to lie to you, in around the new year, so back enjoying it now and back in love again.
Had it been hard, because obviously sitting on the outside and obviously still dipping in and out and speaking to people, you know, a lot of times the Leicester board came up as potentially, obviously hadn't changed in a long time, and what had it changed with the time, and did that play?
I'll give you a get out here. If you're under lock and key, you can say you're under lock and key. But if you can answer, we'd love you to.
Yeah, it's just obviously it comes out that way, and I was just wondering, is it all a myth and everything was okay at that level, or did it make it harder?
No, look, I can only speak personally from my dealings with the board. I thought they were pretty good, and they were trying to get it right. I think the people who were on the board, you know, the misconception about the Leicester board is that, you know, the fans always think that they're getting paid a lot of money and they're, you know, they're doing X, Y, and Z. They all do it for free. They all do it for a love of the team and the region and the county. So from that point of view, I'll set that straight. And my dealings with the board were pretty good, pretty supportive. I guess I found myself in the role at a really unique time, sort of a week, 2 weeks into the season. I think we lost to Exeter in 18, and I was told, look, you're going to do this on an interim basis just for a couple of months until we can replace you, because, you know, we want to get someone experienced in and someone who's, you know, who's been there and done it. And so from my point of view, and one of the things that I did wrong, and I sort of would advise anybody in a similar situation who gets a gig on an interim basis, is you got to just run with it, you know, the way you want to run with it, not keep the peace and just kind of tap dance around the big issues. And that was kind of what I thought. So, you know, someone else is coming in to deal with this, so I'll just, you know, hold fire. And then it wasn't until sort of January, February that I got the job in a permanent role. And then I was going, okay, well, I'd actually been down sort of 3-4 months of a route that I didn't really want to go down. And then you're trying to change everything then towards the end of the season, when there was things very wrong. You know, I thought, you know, the culture in the place had eroded over a good few years. And there were some players there who I didn't think wanted to be there or didn't want to necessarily represent Leicester or win. And that comes from some bad signings. And just sort of, I think when you lose as many head coaches as we did, you know, different coaches have their ideas on the way the game wants to be. They want to play the game. And as such, they recruit to that model. And then you chop it and change it again. And effectively, we had done that for quite a while. So then, you know, straight away you find yourself January, February, and you're in a relegation battle. And certainly because Leicester had been successful for quite a while, I felt that we were in for a lot of kicking. I think a lot of people were kind of going, yeah, this is going to be great. Leicester are going down. And that added pressure into the squad and into the team. And it just, you know, it was one of those things. It was everything we had to do to try and keep Leicester up that season. And to be quite honest, there were some unbelievable performances from some players who are there and who are no longer there, that I managed to keep the side up. And then you sort of go into, which was going to be sort of this season. And again, you know, recruit a really great coach in Steve and, you know, sort of managed to start getting things right. And then you run into a pandemic where, you know, you're introducing wage reductions and you've got all sorts of issues. So, it was interesting timing. But I think there can be a little bit of cloak and dagger stuff. I think definitely we got things wrong. Again, I love the club. I don't want to hurt anyone. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus. So I'm not going to. But I think that's it's interesting. I wouldn't have blamed the board, to be quite honest with you, Ted.
Would you do it again? Would you do it again and do it differently, or have you kind of done it? I mean, does love and the interest still remain do the job?
That's a fantastic question. I think I would. Yeah, I would do it again. I've learned a lot of big lessons that I would definitely do it differently. And you know, I think that's kind of par for the course on anything that's a regret. You know, it's a learning experience. There's huge things that I would change.
Can you go into some of those? I'd love to know, because everybody speaks so highly of you as a person, a character.
I think it's difficult. I think it's difficult because you're going to talk about sort of making changes and the changes that need to be made and actually doing those. And I think it's very difficult from when you're in an environment for such a long time to get the changes you want across the line, because it's like, oh, well, we can't do that. We can't afford that. We can't do that. And whereas you get new coaches come in and actually suddenly there's real, you know, there's the ability to make big changes. But no, there's definitely lots of things that I do differently. And, you know, as I said, I love the sport. Rugby's a great sport, absolutely brilliant sport, you know, friendships for life with a lot of people. And I've been very, very lucky to play in great teams and against some great teams and got some great stories. Even Tins has never come out and told the story about when I think I might have bitten you once at King's Home, Tins. But it was an accident. But it was a great sport from that.
It
was a different time then, though.
Yeah, it was. I think you were trying to put.
Where did the accidental bite take place?
Bottom of the ruck in on about 30-meter line, straight in front of the sticks at the end you run out at now. So yeah.
I had some quite interesting ones with Leicester in the fact that, because I knew quite a lot of the guys quite well, whether it be Leon or Geordie, there was quite a lot of trying to annoy the other, because they were all fierce competitors. Like Leon's got like the shortest fuse in the history of the world. The things that would be frowned upon now, the odd ball bag flick or something like that, it would just literally blow his mind and literally knock him off his game, and he'd go ballistic. So there was a bit of that goes on, and sometimes it worked the other way too.
I remember playing against Lewis, England, Ireland at Lansdowne Road. It would have been probably that era as well. And Lewis obviously hated it. He used to wear contacts, so he used to really annoy him when anything happened to his eyes, but he hated his eyes being touched. So I had him in a ruck again, trying to pull his contact lenses out and just fiddle with him. And he completely lost his mind. He was gonna swing. He didn't know who it was until I whispered in his ear, it's only me. But he managed to knee drop me later in the game. Couldn't walk properly for 2 weeks. But yeah, it was a very different era. It wasn't
friendships.
It wasn't like it is now. It doesn't actually probably sounds pretty bad. And I said I beat him. I didn't bite him. It was more of a nibble.
It's a nibble. It was a friendly nibble.
You've admitted to gouging and biting inside 2 minutes. This is not the reputation I remember. I'm not sure if you will recall this, but do you remember a feature that Graham Simmons did on you, which would have been way back in the day? And there was a lot of black and white in there, actually. And I think he called you, or he referred to the fact that you'd been called the George Best of rugby. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I remember that.
Where did the tag, the George Best of Rugby, come from?
After Ben Kayser's wedding, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, no. That was off the field. I was going to say, did you George Best as much off the field as on the field?
No, to be quite honest, that name came from Dean Richards. Dean Richards, when I joined after Bob Dwyer was in charge, he had left in, I think, February 98. So Bob Dwyer signed me and Dean took over. And I think it was probably quite enigmatic at the time in that they didn't really know where to play me. So I played my school rugby as a 10, and then I played a sort of 15 when I came over to Leicester, and everyone was kind of in every game. They were going, oh, he's a 13, he's a 10. I was kind of getting moved up and down the back line, and it made me a great utility to sit on the bench because, you know, those days, two backs on the bench and I could play anywhere in the back line. But I was also very, very skinny. So I don't know why, because it wasn't like I'd ever really been out boozing or done a huge amount of boozing with the likes of Dean Richards and sort of some seriously scary drinkers. So he had said it in an interview and said, oh, he's like the George Best. I think it was because I was young and I was Irish, but I don't know.
I'm sure I remember they had you doing like tricks in the car park.
Yeah, I know.
Yes. That's exactly the same feature.
But the
question is, how does the George Best of rugby fit into a mob that was Dean Richards, John Wells, Martin Johnson, the ABC club? I mean, was it a second home, or were you always sort of a little more comfortable looking from the outside in? By the sound of it, the gouging and the biting, you were quite happy to roll up the sleeves and dive right in.
Yeah, I think I was, when I arrived, I was so small that they kind of, I think, probably felt sorry for me. They all felt that they needed to look after me. But there's only so much that they'll look after you. I think you have to have a bit of steel or a bit of metal in you somewhere that sort of enables you to continue going. We trained hard. We trained team v team flat out, and we had two very, very good teams. So if you weren't willing to put it in physically, you'd really get found out. Now, I did my best, and I think that was probably all that ever could have been asked for. I was never the most physical, but yeah, I just got stuck in, and I don't know, I've never actually asked them what they saw in me or why they managed to keep me around, but I am, yeah, no, certainly in my latter days I learned how to be a little bit cheaper than I should have been, I suppose.
Very interesting. What do you remember, Tins, of playing against the George Best?
I just think, I mean, obviously it's a long time ago now, but I think it was just smarts. Obviously, he has, and this is not having a go, it wasn't the biggest, so people always thought they could physically dominate him, but then as you see, he's quite happy to bite people and gouge them. So he was quite happy to throw his body in the way, and he had just, you know, it's maybe a forgotten art, the way of sliding on a pass and just making space become bigger by not really doing that much, but it confused the opposition 13s or whatever. He always could hit a good line, wasn't scared of running a hard line. So he had rugby smarts, you know, completely. And I think that all-round package at that time, you know, you look at someone like Matt Perry, it was very similar, very skillful, hard as nails, even though they don't necessarily look hard as nails. Obviously, as well, Pezza Fitz, probably the George Best as well. The off-field is exceptional as well. And I think it was that time of that sort of, that was the right time for a player of sort of Geordie's makeup, and he excelled in it. And then obviously knowing how to fit into a team, and he understood his role within that team and how to best put it on the field. And I think with the players around him, they all managed to get the best out of each other.
It was such a glittering career. I mean, there were so many amazing moments, but there's so many bits of silverware as well. You know, I mentioned the 8 Premiership titles, the 2 Heineken Cups, which were...
8 Prem titles. That's just
outrageous.
You know, the sickening thing, Tins, I think I lost in 5 or 6. So that is
rondonculous when you talk.
You could have given Gloucester that one where we finished top of the table, but you decided to beat us by 43 points or whatever. And
you know what the worrying thing about that was? Whoever was doing your exit strategy was really not on it, because what we did that day was you were going to try and kick it onto Alassana Tuilagi. So I swapped with him. Every time you were going to box onto him, I swapped with him, put him to fullback, caught the box kick, and then just passed it to him on the track.
And he just ran straight at Ryan Lamb. And Ryan Lamb was like,
He was honestly one of his angry days. The thing with Alassana, as you always worried, you know, myself and Scott Hamilton played with Sana for quite a while in the back three. And, you know, sometimes he'd turn up and he wouldn't have his hair braided. And Scotty would just be like, oh, mate, we've got some work to do today because Al's, you know, he's not here. But if he turned up hair braided, boots polished, it was game on. And it was like that day just in the changing room, Wickenham, I'm looking at him, and he had red and green braids, Leicester colours put in. And I was going, uh-oh.
Give him the ball.
But it was just, you just kept serving it up. It was like, okay, I'm going to just catch these boxes and feed it to Al. It was like,
It's like a pilot fish just tagging alongside a blue whale and picking up whatever the scraps are. It's glorious. But when you look at that, we talk about 8 Prem titles, 2 Heineken Cups, a Grand Slam, which for Ireland in that, I mean, it was 50 odd years, wasn't it, in between Grand Slams. Alliance, you know, Lions Tour as well. Do you have particular moments, memories, achievements that stand taller than others for you?
Yes, I would say that the 2 Heineken Cup wins were very, very momentous occasions. One of my favourite games, and I think quite a few of the guys who I've played with, it's coming up on the 20th anniversary of that first 2001 win in Paris. And that game was absolutely epic. Just my memories from that. Great memories. You know, we went over, we stayed in Versailles, just a little bit outside Paris. And we were kind of told, you know, we'd built a real siege mentality around the fixture, and that, you know, we were going to Parc des Princes, which was a stadium that I would have watched Five Nations being played at when I was a kid and would have really wanted to play there. It was defunct because the Stade de France had been built, so they weren't using the Parc des Princes, but we were playing Stade Francais at the Parc des Princes. And so just the excitement levels from that alone was big for me. And we stayed, and I can remember getting into the Parc des Princes and almost driving down underneath the stadium, and just the whole atmosphere in the changing room was, you know, I'm looking around the changing room as a 21-year-old, and I'm looking at guys like John Owen, Backey, and Wig, and they look nervous. It was, you know, it was their first outing. I touched on it earlier, after they lost in '96, and so they, you didn't often see those guys nervous. You didn't often see those guys kind of pale and, you know, taking the deep breaths. So very much straight away, you know that you're in a game, and then you walk out of the changing rooms in the Parc des Princes, and there's a sliding door at the top, and you could hear the noise every time the sliding door opened from the bottom of the corridor. You could just hear this noise, you could almost see it spilling through the doors. And when you came through the doors onto the field, you know, you're talking 45, 50 minutes before kickoff, and you couldn't hear anything. It was just like, it still now makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. It was just, I compare it to having like transistor radios with like static just on each shoulder, just going shh. And it was just the game itself lived up to it, like exactly what it was about. I managed to break myself inside about 20 minutes, but Dean being Dean typically left me on until 60th minute or 56th minute. I had a hip pointer, which is, along with paper cuts and toes up there, is the sorest injuries known to men. But yeah, great game. And it was, they had Diego Dominguez and he was kicking goals and he did everything. And you know, the decisions weren't going our way, but stayed in it. And then, you know, Leon gets a couple of tries and you win the game. Stimo knocks a kick over from the touchline to win 34-30. So I think that was a really, really special game. After that, you know, you've got caps for Ireland and the Lions and big games. So as I said, I think big games are the memories will stay with you. The big losses, they're the ones that really hurt more. So, yeah. Be better about those.
When you've been in that many finals, it's of course.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
The other thing, if I remember about that 0-1 final, is that they left, didn't you? You were left out there for ages before Stade Francais emerged, didn't you? Wasn't that right? And they all got very warmed up before kickoff.
Tasty, yeah. So we went out first, and obviously being French at home, I believe they were trying to get them to come out onto the field, but they were doing the old, no, leave them out there, you know, let them soak in the crowd and the French crowd. And it seemed to be, I don't know the numbers, but it seemed to be at least half of the stadium was green. So we weren't bothered, but I can remember we were there. And as they walked out, they had the majority of the French pack, and they came walking to the halfway line. And I can remember Darren Garforth just turned around and went straight across. So there was a standoff. The referee wasn't even out yet. I think he was trying to get those guys out. There was a standoff on the halfway line, and I just thought, well, it's gonna go. Like it very nearly went into a full on fist fight before the final started, because none of our team were going to take a step back. So it was going to be a very interesting start to a game of rugby.
You are both. I'd love to know what you'd pay to drink from a bottle that would take you back to moments like that again. They are very rare, but so on. But I mean, Tins, you must have equal number of them. I mean, do you get where do you find your kick now, Jordan? Obviously, expecting number three is a fairly big one, but
that's a pretty big kick. I don't know. It's weird. I suppose you compartmentalize things, really. That doesn't really seem like reality. You know, it seems like, as you say, a different life. Like you've got all the memories and you've got it all. I love when we can getting together with my teammates. And I think, you know, it's a measure of sort of the quality of the culture, that when all of the words are gone, that what remains are just the friendships and the camaraderie between those guys. So I love getting together with those guys and catching up on big things like that. I find the whole rugby thing really strange. I think a few years ago, having sort of retired from international rugby in about 2011, it was probably about 16, 17, probably about 5 years before I sat down in front of a Six Nations game to watch it. And again, you know, you can really, really sit in and enjoy it, and sat down at home and was watching the Six Nations. And my wife said to me, "Do you not find it strange that you used to do this?" And I just couldn't get my head around that. I was like, no, like that was then. This is now. Like this is, I want to watch it. I want to turn it on and just like listen and just enjoy it. And it was, I suppose it's just almost different life, isn't it?
Then and now. Tins, which would be the moment you drink from the bottle? If that's a question that makes any sense.
Too easy, World Cup.
Would you go there? Just when you look back now and you go there now and you just think that was very, very special.
Summer tour 2000, where we beat South Africa for the first time, and the 4 days that ensued afterwards.
You're drinking from a very different bottle at that point, I think. I was talking more about atmosphere.
In South Africa, you can drink from any bottle you want. I think that was special because I still believe that was what changed our mentality of where that took that team, getting that win on their home soil. And plus, hostile crowd at Bloemfontein. And it just, like, the proper pressure was on. We should have won the first test. We didn't win it. But that was the atmosphere I wanted to play in. I liked a Friday night against Wales in the Millennium Stadium, where it was just hostile, nasty. That was what I loved playing in. And I think, you know, that was what was served up in that. And then from that day, obviously, we never lost South Africa again until after the World Cup. We didn't lose to New Zealand. We didn't lose to Australia. So as a young man, as a 23-year-old going to a World Cup, 24-year-old going to a World Cup, I'd only suffered one defeat to a Southern Hemisphere team in 3 years, which, you know, and I still think that came off the back of that second test win.
It was a good day. Great moments. Jordan, what's in the file of facts at the moment? What's on the to-do list? Do you want to get back into it? On a tracksuit again or assess? It's good stuff with the media. Are you enjoying a bit of that?
I'm really enjoying the media stuff, yeah. I was very, very lucky to get dragged into some of the ITV stuff for the Six Nations, which has been really enjoyable.
Great Six Nations, though.
It's been some good games. I think obviously in the beginning it was, you know, kind of we were dealing with large passages of kicking the ball, but it's improved. It has been good, and there's been some big games and some exciting rugby played. So just really enjoyed that, and that sort of came about out of nothing. A few bits and pieces kind of popping up off the field, which have been quite interesting to get my teeth into while I'm doing nothing. Would I get back into it? Yeah, I suppose you would. I would if the right gig came up, and that's something that, you know, I'll keep looking for and keep sort of trying to chat. I think when you really enjoy rugby, it's something that, you know, you're constantly speaking to people, trying to develop, trying to grow. I've been very lucky, you know, and the rugby community, as I touched on earlier, has been really good. So I've had some really great Zooms and chats with people and sort of catching up with what people are doing. And as well as know enough people in around the game that it's interesting. But it's certainly a challenging job. I don't envy the guys who are in the role at the minute, and particularly when you're under the pump, it's a tough place to be.
How do you think having no relegation this year is going to affect that style? Do you think it takes that pressure off a lot of people? Would you expect, you know, there to be some shocks from the bottom clubs because they don't have to worry about it? Or?
I don't think so. I think sort of the mindset in the Premiership, certainly at the moment, is one that you go out to win every game. And that's one of the great things about the Premiership is, you know, when teams sense blood, they will go for it. You know, one of the teams down the bottom, when they see, you know, a team with a couple of guys away on international duty or, you know, a couple of injuries or for whatever reason, I think everyone tries to really take their chances when they can. No one wants to be in that bottom spot. Not having relegation certainly takes the pressure off. I think teams will probably be a little bit more sensible / pragmatic about it and go, okay, well, you know, look, we've got a build here and we've got the opportunity to, you know, we know we're not going to have to play in the Championship next season. So we can take the risk at maybe playing a couple of younger guys or experiment with selection to a certain extent. I do think it takes the pressure off. I'm not sure how happy I am about it long term. But is what it is.
Yeah. Did you notice that as a massive change when obviously COVID first kicked in and obviously you were playing two games a week maybe, and you had to rely on people that necessarily you wouldn't have had to have gone to in the first place? And did you find, because of there was no atmosphere and there was no people there, that some people that you didn't expect stood up because of the pressure of the crowd wasn't there, and some that you hoped would stand up didn't actually?
Oh, that was the way that Leicester looked at that block of 8-9 games last back end of sort of the completion of last season after COVID. It was, you know, the squad wasn't big enough to physically go. You're going to have to play these 9 games and rotate small numbers. So it was very much a case of giving some people opportunities and seeing, you know, who would grow and who would develop and you know, do what you wanted to do. And it was a challenging thing to have done, but it was certainly a case of Leicester knew that it wasn't imperative to win every game. So it was one of those ones that we just needed to get through. But but some young players did a really solid job of stepping up in tough circumstances as well.
Final question. I want to talk about Hambo's thing with you, Tins. Another great Leicester man. The winner at the Aviva will be,
I think, Ireland.
Old habits die hard. Because?
I think that... I think they've put a few more convincing performances together. I think they actually looked like beating Wales. And obviously, you know, a quality or a good Scottish side, and they did a solid job away from home on the weekend. I think they'll be certainly excited about bringing England to Lansdowne Road on St. Patrick's weekend, which is a real shame that there's not a fans in the stadium, because it would have been a very, very big weekend. But I think they're building nicely. I know England played well against France. Be interesting to see what they do. But I think Ireland have an edge.
Final, because we've done the other games.
Well, my body's very happy because I'm not at Cheltenham all this week and I don't have to go to Ireland either, so my liver's doing dancing.
Dialysis is down this year or seasons past.
Look, I think if England turn up, I think both teams, well, I think Ireland are playing a lot better than I've seen them play in a long time. Speed of ball, you've got our mate Tag. Tag's back, sidestepping, goose stepping.
Oh, wow, like Phil Bennett. Incredible scenes.
It was incredible. You have those players coming. I think Keenan's been brilliant at fullback. I think Henshaw's been fantastic. Lowe, I think you've got, plus then you've got your forwards, Ryan, as we said, Furlong.
James Ryan's out. And Robbie Henshaw's
out. Now, but you've had those players.
Oh, sorry, Gary Ringrose is out. Sorry.
You've had those players playing at a level they haven't played for a couple of years. Speed of ball's been really, really good, and which has given them quick ball and they're getting over game line. So I'm interested by if England can reproduce the intensity, the performance and the intent that they had on the weekend, I think they can still get a win. But I think it's a close game that could go either way.
How good is Robbie Henshaw?
Yeah, he's been brilliant. This
is your Lions 12?
For me,
at
yes.
the moment. I mean, I got abused at not putting Fico in, but I was like, well, Fico hasn't played all the games in that Six Nations squad, but he's just ever present for them at the moment, and it doesn't. I mean, he got a bit feisty, didn't he? When who did he smash into touch? Oh, he smashed
Juan van der Merwe.
Yeah, into touch, and yeah, I was like, well, he was going into touch anyway, Robbie. But that's what you—that's what you sort of need sometimes as you're 12. So he's just ready for any occasion to stand up, and you need those in your team. And I think he's been brilliant, actually.
I like that. I really like that because I thought he'd managed to brush Duan and managed to brush the winger off, and I thought he thought, here we go, and then just got absolutely smoked. But
I did think actually about 2 minutes later, Van der Merwe ran over him. I went through him. I was like, I bet he wishes he could turn around and go, hee-hee, and run off.
Too busy. That was off the left side line-out, wasn't it? Yeah. I think he claimed he speed-bumped him. He fell over at play two. So.
Slowed him enough.
And as a line, I've got to ask you as well, series at home, are you happy with that? Is that exciting? Are we just desperate for a titanic tussle? We're hearing 4 tests, or... does that erode, as a former tourist, the beauty of touring?
Look, I think touring with the Lions is very, very special, and touring with any team is special. You know, when you build that bond, it's a shame that it's not happening in overseas. But to be quite honest, I think it was more important that it took place. Fans want to see it. The potential of actually getting some fans in to watch the games is just mouthwatering. And in an ideal world, everyone would love to be sort of down sunning themselves, but you know that may not be the case. But it's brilliant that it's gone ahead. Very, very exciting, and hopefully it can be some cracking rugby played.
Fingers crossed. Very nice to have you on. I'm sorry. Thank you for coming, because I know you've got some fairly sort of heavy duty priorities right now. But it's been really nice to have you on, Jordan. Thank you. And what we'd love to do, if you'd be interested, we'll get a live show together at some point. We'll get some Cuban cigars and some Armagnac, and we'll let you and Ben go for round two. Just a light Dubonnet on the rocks.
Mate, I'm ready. I'm ready for that. That sounds great.
Have you ever drank Armagnac?
Probably not enough, but then it seems to that seems to be the best way of approaching it.
Do yourself a favour, Tins. Go buy yourself a bottle of Armagnac before you sign up to it. Just taste it in your own home. It was wasn't pleasurable.
It's the home brew Armagnac.
Yeah, the home brew.
Sounds,
I think,
even more that, kind of terrifying.
It definitely just petrol.
Just what we've got, both of you. Tins, do you want to mention the Hambo auction thing?
We could just talk about it. Obviously, Hambo would usually be having his big fundraiser.
This is Matt Hampson for our broader listeners and viewers.
He would usually be having his big Six Nations dinner at the Battersea Evolution in London. Usually is the place where they raise a lot of their money for their year. Obviously, not possible this year, but they are going to try and do an online auction, and they asked me to pick my ultimate Six Nations team. Yeah. So I'll run you through it. Sorry, Jordy, you didn't make it, but
there's no point.
So I went for it. So this is Six Nations. This is post 2000. This is where it comes. So many questions.
Some big calls here. Some big calls.
So if I went 1, I've got Kian Healy. 2, Rory Best. 3, Phil Vickery. 4, Paul O'Connell. 5, Alan Wynne-Jones. 6, Thierry Dusautoir. 7, Martin Williams. 8, Sergio Parisse. 9, Mike Phillips. 10, Johnny Wilkinson. 11, George North. 12, Yannick Jojon. 13, Brian O'Driscoll. 14, Shane Williams. And 15, Stuart Hogg. Discuss.
I mean, no Martin Johnson in there is extraordinary. There's never 15 picks without that man.
So this is the thing. Is obviously Jono finished playing.
You're basically saying that Jono was worthless when he won the World Cup in 2003 for you.
Well, this is what we're doing, is the fact that then obviously he only played 3 years in the Six Nations. So do you then pick someone, you know, Alan Wynne has got...
Just the best team. That's all they wanted to know, Tins. They don't want a life story. They just want the best team.
See, that's it. There it is, cut to the shit. So, yeah, it's...
So what's the significance of that 15? What's happening with it?
So, basically, Ben Mosley, who's a great supporter, artist of... supporter of the charity, he is now going to put... that into a picture, which obviously people are going to probably disagree with and not going to want to buy it. And then it will be up for auction, but he's going to do a fabulous painting, and his paintings do go for quite a bit of money. I did an auction in I don't even know which lockdown it is now. It's like a movie. It's like a bad movie that they keep remaking, isn't it? I think I was in lockdown one at the time when he did a painting for me, and we managed to sell that for 20 bags, 20 grand. So hopefully we can pull something up together and we can get that. And it will be, if you want to do it, you can go on, it's www.hambosauction.com, or if you search on Just Giving, you can also get the website there.
Tim, that artist, he's unbelievable. I've seen some stuff. It's honestly so, so good. But I am... Some people might not be able to afford the 20 grand that this is.
Well, you might get a steal. You might get a steal.
But I think there's lots of bits and pieces.
But yeah, there's loads. There's Manu's got a signed shirt on there. I've got, I think I've got a four ball if you want to like playing golf and we're allowed to do it again.
Glad you played golf, Tim.
I'd love to. Golf is my thing. I do actually have a sneaky little golf practice area. So I've been literally spending a lot of time in there. I think it's a great worthwhile course for Hambo, and I managed to speak to him a fair bit last week, and you know, he's really happy because even though they haven't been able to necessarily do loads of things at the centre, yes, it's been open for a few guys to come in and do fizz, but then what it has been great for is they've managed to get the accommodation block sort of knocked up, and it's going up really nicely, which has given him something to focus on, which has been good for him.
I drove past it the other day. It looks amazing. The accommodation bit's going to go, and I'd say it's been, they've been doing some good work. I'm actually catching up with him tomorrow on Zoom. Yeah.
Perfect.
Good man. Send him our very best. He's an absolute superstar and a great, great friend of the show.
Can we just say, by the way, anyone who reads that team on social media, be kind.
Don't be kind. Tyler, I think
Jordan, we had this argument, didn't we, Alex, about whether it should be Jason Robertson at fullback, and then you pulled out the fact that Hogg's the only player to be back-to-back player of the tournament or something, and he's playing.
Don't blame me. Don't suck me into your vortex.
You're just going to throw me out, are you? That we didn't discuss this.
I don't know what you're on about.
It was a joint team, you Judas.
No.
That's why you never played.
Yeah, quite right. I just talk
big
rubbish.
I'll be happy either.
I know.
Who won't?
Lawrence.
Or he'll back Delalio. I mean... Are you trying to say
you are ridiculous?
What do you know about the game?
Jamie Heaslip's probably going to be crying in his beard.
Yeah.
Tony O'Brien.
He was close.
Close.
Yeah. There's a lot of great players.
What did he ever do?
I don't know.
If I buy this painting, or if I bid on this painting, can I scratch some of the people out?
redraw. He'll do a repaint for you. And crudely point Jono's eyebrows on.
Who did you pick? Paulie O'Connell and
Alan Wynn.
In fairness, you should have done a bench, just kept everyone happy.
I'll let you two continue squabbling about this because we're going to wrap up at this point. The final thing I've got to tell people about is that we've got our Good Bad Rugby shooting day. Lots of interest around. I think we've got just a couple of spots left, actually. If you fancy coming along, 24th of June, raising money for the RPA, events at goodbadrugby.com. Plus the return to rugby on the 29th of March. The game is open again. The clubhouses will be teeming. Pick up a paintbrush, get yourself down there, find some boots. Let's get the game back up and running as quickly as we possibly can. Have a look at englandrugby.com for all the details. That is it for the Good, the Bad and the Rugby this week. Thank you to Mike. Thank you to Ben. Jordan, good luck. Are you watching on the sofa with a bundle of joy, or have you managed to find some media work?
I'm commentating for ITV for the game this weekend.
Clever.
So I may, hopefully the baby's here. Otherwise, I might be making a phone call for someone to replace me, substitute last minute because I am, but no, we think we're going to be okay. We're going to be in the next couple of days.
Mikey O'Tindall will take over for you. Give me a call.
You have to have 2 points of Guinness and put your Irish accent on.
Yeah.
Unless they did any Google searching about me and Irish rugby, and then they probably would never include me as an Irishman.
I don't know, mate. You've got all the attributes of an Irishman.
the ones that matter, certainly. Jordan, look after yourself. It's been lovely to chat, and hopefully we'll see you back in the game sooner rather than later. Thank you for swinging by.
Take care.
Tins and I are back on Friday with our Premiership preview show. The whole gang will be back together on GBNR next week to debrief on the Six Nations. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. See you in 7 days' time. Take it away, Rob Brydon.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.